dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 544 of Unwelcome Guests, Living Arrangements Beyond Nation States. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show is subtitled U.S. Cities, Past, Present and Future, but it ranges wider than that because it also looks at the health effects and the effects on community of living in urban Western sprawl, and it looks at the transition away from national governments to what Jeff Vail calls scale-free self-sufficiency. Our first interview is with James Howard Kunstler on the maldevelopment of the US cities under not just flawed thinking and sort of wannabe modernization for the sake of it, but also short-term self-interest by those with a vested interest in maximizing energy usage, a strategy which James Howard Kunstler on another occasion has called the biggest misallocation of resources in history. Now, he's at odds with Jeff Vail, who's speaking in a second hour, because he's saying that the periphery of the cities are likely to wither and die. He chastises Lewis Mumford for being too quick to reject the existing status quo in favour of a better status quo. I just set to wondering whether, in a low-energy future, trying to actually change the pattern of the cities might itself be counterproductive, and people might be better off by adapting what they already have. I had to trim this slightly to fit it in, so if you'd like to listen to the unedited version, you can get it either from KunstlerCast number 125 or from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/544. The next voice you hear is Duncan Crary, co-host of KunstlerCast.
I would like to ask you, if you had the chance to go back to, let's say, 1946 in America, and you had the chance to address the American people about the grand experiment of suburbia that they were about to embark upon, what do you think you might say to them? Now, keep in mind, they're actually listening to you because you're a man from the future.
That is a very interesting question. I think the first thing that I would advise the people to do is not to listen to all the Rotarians and business boosters out there who were full of great ideas for maximizing their own profits at the expense of everybody else, of, you know, privatizing their profits while impoverishing the places where everybody else ends up living. And that's pretty much what the process of suburbanization did, although that's kind of an abstraction. You know, I had an interesting experience last night. I was watching that new George Clooney movie called The American, and most of the movie takes place in an Italian hill town. Very, very beautiful place of, you know, old buildings and narrow passageways and beautiful intimate streets and tranquility, and there wasn't one object in the whole townscape, from the smallest micro scale to the macro scale, that wasn't beautiful in one way or another, or appealing, or designed to make you feel better about being human. Of course, George Clooney plays this American, this desperado who's on the run. He's an international assassin. So the desperation that he shows kind of reminded me of the desperation of American life as expressed on our landscape, you know, in these miserable agglomerations of whirring motorways and parking lots and the frantic scenes at all the strip malls and just the hectic absurdity of the way we live, as opposed to the beauty and tranquility of how people still live in Europe. And I guess I'm haunted by this divergence of what happens to Western society after the Second World War. We make our decisions and go our way, and the Europeans make their decisions and they go their way. And for the most part, although they certainly did have their mistakes, you know, the British tried their own utopian experiments in building new towns. And, you know, the French had the experiments of Corbusier, and the Germans still had a hangover from the Bauhaus. But on the whole, what they opted for was going back to the traditional town, the traditional city, and the traditional centers of the town and the cities. And we made the totally opposite decision. You know, we decided, our cities aren't, we don't like them too much, and they're old, and they require so much maintenance, and we've got all this new aluminum and plastic. Let's just build a bunch of new stuff outside of them.
Would you try to convince them to believe in the city again, like not to give up on the city? Would you have some kind of an argument to try to convince them that this is a better living arrangement?
Well, personally, yes, I would have done that, and there was a figure on the scene who got about halfway there, but I think that his arguments were kind of corrupted by some of the fashions du jour, and I'm speaking of Lewis Mumford, who was on the scene as really kind of a lone voice in favor, or at least against the suburban experiment from the very start. Mumford grew up in New York City. I think he was born literally in 1899 or 1900, so he grew up with the entire 20th century, and he lived a long life, well into his 90s. So he saw the whole spectacle. And in the prime of his life, at the high point of his career, the Second World War had come to an end, and he could see where it was going very, very clearly. And, you know, he understood the import of the General Motors Futurama exhibit at the 1939 World's Fair, and he understood how economic opportunists would want to take that idea and turn it into fortunes for themselves at the same time that they destroyed American cities. The trouble is, he got kind of waylaid on his journey to this by what was called then the Garden City Movement, which sprang up really. It came out of the British utopian experiments with the Garden City at the turn of the century with Ebenezer Howard and guys like that. And some of their experiments were actually built in Britain. And the whole idea was, you know, we have to develop some way to house this exploding population. There was no thought given to the idea that an exploding population wasn't necessarily a good thing. You know, that it was, in the early 20th century, it was inevitable. There were going to be more people, we got to house them, and we got to house them in a rational way. Ebenezer Howard's garden cities tended to be highly diagrammatic. And by that I mean they were abstractions. They were schematic. You know, they weren't based on the kind of emergent, nonlinear behavior that you really get when people come together to do something, like to construct this multi-layered organism made of many parts, composed by many people, called a city or a town. The Garden City new towns in England were built, and they have endured. They haven't done that badly, as abstract as they are. But some of the things that the offshoots of it in America were not quite as successful. Some of them were pretty good. There was an experiment in Camden, New Jersey, called Yorkship Village. And that's a very interesting place. It was built for the naval workers in the First World War, around 1917. It's a brick town, very, very tight in the sense that the buildings are close together. They're all brick. It's on kind of a, what we call a transect, meaning, you know, it goes from very dense at the center to becoming less dense towards the edge. The whole thing is maybe a quarter of a mile walk in diameter, so it's not that big, but it's big enough. But the interesting thing about Yorkship Village in Camden is that it has endured for, like, you know, 90 years. And it has never become a slum, despite the fact it's in the slummiest city on the East Coast, Camden, New Jersey. It was originally inhabited by working-class shipyard workers, and in one way or another, they passed these houses down to their descendants who have kept them. They've never been wealthy people. It's never been gentrified, but it's always been maintained, you know, which tells you something of the sturdiness and the value of that particular place. By the way, it has a wonderful core with a kind of a, if I remember it, it's either a square or maybe even an octagon. I don't quite remember it. I was there 10, 12 years ago. There's a school, I think, on one side of this. the shops are, you know, line this public square, and it's the logical magnet for people to go to do their day shopping. And it's lovely and charming and convenient, and it's enjoyed by working class people. You know, every other, you know, 99.999% of the other working class people in America are out there in the burbs, including some of the worst ones, because they have the least money, right? So that's one. There's another utopian experiment called Mariemont, somewhere in the vicinity of Cincinnati, and it's a similar thing, but it's a little more upscale. I think the real reason that the Garden City movement failed in America was simply because once these things started getting built out, the Depression started, and that was it. You know, there was no real building going on in America for 20 years with the Depression and the war. So those experiments just kind of fell by the wayside, much as perhaps the new urbanist experiments of the 1990s and early 2000s may fall by the wayside as, you know, transitional forms that didn't quite make it. The real transition that occurred, of course, was the suburban project, which was resumed with a vengeance in the early 50s.
So, Jim, what would you say, since we're time traveling right now, what would you say to Lewis Mumford?
I'd say, Lewis, you really got to take this back a little bit further even than you want to go, and don't try to be so avant-garde, you know, and actually look at what we have in the traditional town and the existing neighborhood and the existing fabric of American cities and towns, and try to find the value there and retain it, and don't get so lost in experimentation. You know, as Andres Duany has said very cogently a few times, the 20th century is a history of experimenting on people, mostly the poor, who can't really escape these experiments. You know, we're going to see that more and more now, of course, as the American middle class disappears and everybody becomes poor except for Lloyd Blankfein and his employees at Goldman Sachs and a few other people. But, yeah, I would tell Lewis Mumford to cool it a little bit on the avant-garde modernity and not get so caught up in the notion of, you know, remaking a bright, new, purified world. A lot of these guys were, you know, so traumatized by the tribulation of these two world wars, that what was still on the, very much on their mind was purging all of the awful claptrap of history out of society. They didn't want it anymore because they felt that it had been responsible for all the trauma of all the violence of the 20th century, which was like nothing that had ever been seen before. And they wanted to purify the world. And it wasn't just, you know, Walter Gropius and Corbu and the other modernist starchitects. You know, it was really a meme that ran through the culture. So I would suggest to Lewis, look at what you got. Look at the pattern that's there and see if we can find value in that. I would advise him very strongly, do not allow the freeways to enter the city. If you're going to build limited access highways between the cities, make sure that as they enter the city, that they become domesticated and urbanized and turn them into boulevards and avenues.
It's interesting, Jim, because we just traveled through a corridor leading up to this park, which overlooks the city, that had been, at one point, was just city blocks. Then it was turned into this short highway ramp almost, and then it comes back to a narrow two-lane city street again, almost for no reason. And now, with some stimulus money, the city is filling in that urban pattern again.
Yeah, and by filling it in, they are sort of redomesticating the street and recreating real blocks around it. And the blocks are not super blocks. They're, you know, they're going to be small, properly sized urban blocks so that you get a lot of frontage where the action really is for real estate development.
I love what you said about domesticating it, too, because that little stretch of road that we drove up looks like it just went totally wild. A dog that bit someone, you know?
Yeah, they're in every town where the whole ethos of the Department of Transportation and the traffic engineering officialdom, you know, seeped down to every public works department in America. And they all felt that wherever there was an opportunity to turn some stretch of a city street into a mini freeway, they couldn't resist it. But, you know, one of the things that we did learn in the late 20th century was that cars don't respond to signs that tell them how fast to go. They respond to the handling characteristics of whatever thoroughfare they're on. So if it looks like you can go 50 miles an hour there, people will accelerate and go 50 miles an hour. And as that happens, of course, that kills whatever is around it because, you know, the speed, the velocity of the cars is just a certain killer of neighborhoods and urban fabric that is anywhere near it. And that's one of the it brings us to one of the other sort of car management issues, which is the terrible blunder that city officials made all over America in turning their streets into one-way streets, and the accompanying blunder of removing on-street parking. And that is, you know, first of all, it turned every side street in many American cities into mini freeways. You know, you even see that in places as small as Providence, Rhode Island, or Albany, New York. But that really emanated from the traffic engineering discipline, and it wasn't something, Mumford was not telling people to do that.
Yeah, because I remember we watched that movie called The City, which the narration for it was written by Lewis Mumford. It wasn't narrated.
That was one of those utopian Garden City experiments, which had many elements of the Bauhaus to it, you know, which was the idea with that kind of hybrid of the Bauhaus and the Garden City as it came to America was the cities were so dark and dingy and lightless and unsanitary, and the first priority was providing people with fresh air and light and plumbing and a little bit of grass around them. So, but you take that a little bit further and, you know, you start ruralizing the city. And you don't get any more, you don't get the density or the mixed use that you need for a city to function.
Well, that's why I feel like we're in a strange spot right here, Jim, because I don't know if Lewis Mumford ever came to Troy, but I know he was friends with Russell Sage, who was a wealthy Troy person. So he
philanthropist, and they named a college after him.
Yeah, around here everything's named after the guy and his wife, Emma Willard. But anyway, so Mumford maybe came up here, but I do remember in that film...
He lived in the Hudson Valley down in Armenia.
Okay. So, but I do remember in that movie, you know, he was using Pittsburgh as an example of the city as hell on earth with all the smoke and stuff. Now...
And congestion.
Right.
And the trouble is when you carry decongestion too far, you end up de-urbanizing a place. And whatever that transect is between too much density and not enough, America definitely went too far in the wrong direction so that we ended up deconstructing the whole idea of what a city or a town really is. What you're describing here is actually the urban edge. You know, the idea that there's an edge of town, that there's a point where the city stops and the rural countryside begins. And, you know, up until about 1950, that was pretty sharp in most places. You didn't go from the city to the wilderness because there's a whole, you know, transect of rural typologies as well as urban typologies. But it was much sharper. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about being in European towns and cities, even fairly substantial ones like Florence, Italy, is, you know, you can literally leave your hotel and walk out of town in half an hour and be in the countryside and experience the transition very clearly. And it's a wonderful thing, you know. And one of the terrible consequences of suburbia was that it erased the idea that there was a distinction between any of these things, that it all just became one big mishmash. And in a way, that carried over also into the way we conducted our lives, because our lives became kind of a mishmash of the urban and the rural. One of the big selling points of suburbia was that you could live in a rural place but lead an urban lifestyle. You know, that was how it was first sold. And it was sort of the case, you know, in the first iterations of suburbia, especially in the late 19th century where there really was no motoring. But as we get out of World War II, this rural suburban landscape is no longer really, it doesn't have any rural characteristics anymore, really. It has all the drawbacks of the city and all the drawbacks of the country combined, and none of the benefits of either. You know, it's got all of the congestion of the city in the form of traffic, and it's got all the isolation of the country in the sense that you're isolated in your little pod of your, you know, your raised ranch house, which is connected to everything else only by your Ford Fairlane. So you get to that point right after the war where the USA is facing some choices. And I don't think somebody could have successfully argued against the suburban project, if only because there was such fear that America was going to slip back into the Great Depression, that we were desperate to do anything that would keep business moving. And, you know, there were some conditions that were going on that that really favored that choice. One was that all of our other competitors in the world were flat on their back. You know, they were bombed out and bankrupted from the Second World War. And we were in this interesting position for, you know, a brief few decades where we could manufacture anything we wanted and sell it to these people in these defeated countries and lend them the money to borrow it, you know, which allowed them to get back on their feet finally by the late 60s, pretty much. And the other thing was that we had our own oil supply, and we had a lot of it, and there was very little sense, except for that one crank, M. King Hubbard, you know, the geologist I think he was at Stanford for a while, he was at the Colorado School of Mines for a while, and he worked for some oil companies for a while. You know, and Hubbard developed the idea that the oil story had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that if we weren't careful, we were going to get in trouble when we came to the end, which would probably be around the beginning of the 21st century. So he had that pretty well plotted out as a model. Nobody wanted to listen to that, though. And by the way, he publicly came out with that around 1955, and no doubt he was thinking about it, you know, for many years before he went public with it. It was kind of a risky thing for him to go public because the oil companies, especially the ones that he depended on for his livelihood, didn't want the public to be nervous about the oil supply. They wanted America to keep this suburban project going at full force.
Do you think that Lewis Mumford ever imagined that a place like this neighborhood in South Troy we're looking over would look like this right now? There's no more belching smokestacks anywhere. I mean, that round building we're looking at, they used to actually make gas from coal there. It was very smelly and dirty and toxic. But look at how quiet the neighborhood is now, and look at the absence of smoke and industry. Do you think Mumford ever imagined that's what places like Troy and Pittsburgh would eventually look like?
I think Mumford's imagination, which was very rich, I mean, he was really a great, great writer and thinker, and very much neglected in our time. I think he was fully capable of seeing the curve that we were on. And in fact, you know, if you read some of his really great books from the early 60s, I think the title is The City in History or Cities and Civilization, I don't quite remember. But he has a long, long chapter, and this is 1961 when that was published. The same year, incidentally, that Jane Jacobs published The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she knew Mumford, and they were friends for a while. And in fact, Mumford kind of adopted her as a protege or a kind of a pet. And championed her writings. But then they had a big falling out. And I think that the falling out had to do with sort of what I was describing earlier. Mumford's body of ideas left over from that Garden City experiment period, where he really couldn't shake off the notion that the traditional city was a bad thing in some way. You know, I mean, he had perhaps, I wouldn't say that Mumford had more experience with the American city necessarily than Jane Jacobs. She grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which was an industrial town, a coal mining town, probably full of all of the well-known obnoxious activities that led to people disregarding cities. Mumford grew up in Manhattan and was, you know, really a creature of New York City through the whole 20th century. So he saw some of the worst of city life, including the great tenements of the day, you know, in the Lower East Side, where there were more people living than in Calcutta now. But he saw the great triumphs of the mid-20th century city and, you know, the birth of the skyscraper and the fantastic verve and dynamism of the American city that we associate even with the music of George Gershwin, you know, and the whole way of life of the mid-20th century in America. And I think I think there were elements of that he admired. But I think it might have been a matter of scale. I don't think that even today we have people who are thinking about the city, for the most part, troubled by the sense of the scale that they have attained now and how that's going to be as much of a problem for us as the obnoxious industrialism was for the late 19th and early 20th century people who lived in cities then. You know, for us, it's a matter of scale because our cities are no longer scaled to the energy realities of the future, and they're going to have to compress and contract. And almost nobody is prepared to do that, including especially the architectural community. They're not interested. You know, they have clients who want skyscrapers, and skyscrapers are very profitable for them. You know, you design the building footprint, and, you know, you design the floor plate and the four-floor plan, and then you just repeat it 70 times. And, you know, it's not that difficult. And they make huge commissions on those things. So the architectural community is still on board with the idea of the giant-scaled city of the future of skyscrapers and stuff. Personally, I think we're not going back in that direction. I think that we're headed back towards smaller, finer, smaller scale, smaller size buildings, and that the 19th century cities that we see out there now in all of their dereliction and depopulation and sort of tragic disuse, these are going to be the models of the places that will work for us in the future. Now, there's a lot you can do with them to make them better. You don't have to go back to the 19th century. You know, you can have good plumbing and decent lighting, and you can make provision for public spaces. This is, you know, why I keep on coming back to the idea of what happened in Europe, where they made a totally different set of choices. They decided that they weren't going to throw their cities away. In fact, they were going to rebuild the ones that were really badly damaged, even if they had to do it at the microscopic level, you know. Warsaw and some of those, you know, middle European cities and German cities that were just bombed to smithereens, you know, they went back and they replaced the old buildings that were there before, more or less brick by brick in many cases. You know, their whole neighborhoods, where they really replicated the fabric that had existed there. And it wasn't just an exercise in nostalgia. It was an exercise in really recapturing their own culture and their own history. And we've not been terribly interested in that. It's only really been since 1961, when we made that terrible blunder of knocking down Penn Station, a wonderful building designed by McKim, Mead, and White in the 20th century that was knocked down not more than 60 years later after it was built. You know, it was only after that tragedy that some people in America began to turn around and said, wow, we cannot destroy all of our history. And that history has been erased in a lot of places. You know, some of the more tragic ones are in the Midwest. You know, I'm always amazed when I go to the Midwest and I see these towns whose names we all know from, you know, from popular song and Broadway musicals. And, you know, you go to Rock City and you go to all these old places and there's nothing left. You know, they've destroyed their town centers and many of their historic buildings and driven freeways through them. So, you know, after that disaster of Penn Station, the historic preservation movement was born, and some people became sensitive to what was being lost. But it's still a terrible struggle. You know, every day there are still important, wonderful structures that could be reused and that are beautiful and that were designed with skills that we don't even have anymore are being lost.
So, Jim, I want to switch gears here, and I want to return to addressing the American people in general here in 1946 about some concepts of freedom. Because here in the year 2010, a lot of people are yammering about freedom, and freedom isn't free. But on the other hand, I don't think they realize the many ways they've become held hostage by the system, by our living arrangements, but also our system of commerce. You said something, you wrote something years ago in the New York Times magazine about how when a nation is beholden to importing almost all of its goods from a foreign land, it is a colony. So in other words, like America, we think that we're free and we threw off the yoke of British colonialism only to become a colony to the modern era. Do you remember any of that?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember everything I write. I don't know. maybe that's weird or dumb, but well, we've certainly become the debt slaves of the people who supply us with our salad shooters and above ground pools and other plastic crap, namely China and other Asian places. You know, that's going to be a problem. One of the ideas in Jane Jacobs' later books that's terribly important is the idea of import replacement. Jane wrote a book which I think was titled something like Wealth in the Life of Cities, and she's talking about the American experience in particular, where, you know, we start out as a British colony, and we basically have to get all our finished goods from Europe, you know, not just Britain, but, you know, also from France and other places. And as time goes by in the 19th century, we're making more and more of our own stuff. We're making more of our own textiles, so we don't have to import all the cotton goods from Britain anymore. And we're making more of our household products and, you know, everything from brooms to cheese graters. And pretty soon, you know, you get to the late 19th century, and what do you know? America has become the workshop of the world, and we're making everything we need, and we have a surplus of stuff we can sell to other people. So we've replaced our imports with stuff that we're making ourselves. And what happened in the USA after the Second World War was, you know, especially after 1960, was we went in the other direction, you know, and we started importing more and more stuff and making far less stuff of our own, until now, you know, we're at a point where there are very few things that we actually use that we make ourselves. And we're going to, look, we're going to have to go back in the other direction whether we like it or not. And I don't think that we're going to return to the heyday of the industrial mid-20th century. It's not going to be like 1950 here again. But if we don't make some stuff, we're not going to have anything.
More on the topic of freedom, this suburban promise of your own space and peace and quiet and the freedom of the open road. It's not true, is it? I mean, you're a slave to your commute, and you're a slave to many things.
I would actually disagree with you. It's not entirely false. It's just been terribly corrupted and corroded. Certainly many people are held hostage in their commuting, you know, and that's that can be just terrible. I can't imagine having to drive, you know, 60 miles from the Inland Empire of California to L.A. I mean, that would be awful.
Yeah, well, you can't. It's like being crippled and not having access to your wheelchair if you don't have a car in suburbia.
Well, and also, famously, you know, people who don't drive, children, older people, become second-class citizens in suburbia. I think this is pretty well understood. But, you know, the compensations still are there or have been there for quite a few decades. And the compensations include a certain amount of privacy that you didn't get in the city. You don't have to have anything to do with your neighbors if you don't want to out there. People have more room, more personal space in their dwellings. Now, that was something that, you know, that was also, when you really get down to it, a manifestation of cheap energy and this sort of turbo, hyper, last gasp of the oil fiesta industrial party that we had. And, of course, you know, the houses got biggest at the end of it, you know, when finally the McMansion comes along and you have three people living in a 4,000 square foot house. You know, it becomes pretty insane. But I wouldn't want to downplay the real fact of the situation is that there have been true compensations for people who made the choice to live in suburbia, and these choices were supported by the, you know, the way things were at the time, what we had at the time. The trouble is we don't have that anymore, and those circumstances have changed, so that choice is really no longer going to be available. And, you know, I'm quite sure there's going to be tremendous nostalgia for that. You know, a lot of people are going to remember it very fondly, you know, how wonderful it was to drive up to your 4,000 square foot house and, you know, you never had to talk to the people next door, you never had to leave the place, you know, after supplying it with a certain amount of cheese doodles and beer, you know, you could stay there and watch television for the rest of your life. And, you know, there are a lot of people who would find that very comforting. But sooner or later, we are going to be brought back to the fact that we are social beings and that we need an armature or an infrastructure for a social life, for a civic social life, in which we have to get along with other people and make social decisions and engage in something that has to do with the common good and the public interest, and do it within a physical setting that that allows for that, namely the traditional urban setting, whether it's a town or a city. And it's going to have to be the right scale for, you know, for the resources that are available.
Well, I think if we're going back in time in our time machine, because you had mentioned in that last riff that, you know, these things are understood about suburbia. They're understood now, but in 1946, before it really ramped up, obviously they didn't know what was going to happen in the future, what lay in store for them. And I think if we're going to issue a warning, I think we'd have to warn certain things, like you may be gaining some freedom through this new living arrangement, but you're going to sacrifice other things, like the ability to get around on 2 feet.
Yeah, but that's not what salespeople do. Salesmen don't tell you the bad thing about the product you're buying. They only tell you the good thing. And so much of suburbia was a matter of salesmanship and kind of national hypnosis by salesmanship. So, you know, that's why we bought it hook, line, and sinker. You know, the basic lie behind it all was that it was going to be country living for everybody. And, of course, you know, the truth of it was it turned out to be a cartoon of country living for everybody. And living in a cartoon's not that much fun, unless you're Bart Simpson, you know. But the salesmanship really was able to get past that. And once people are programmed to do that, you don't have to sell them too hard anymore. Once they've got the initial programming, the salesman only has to come in every so often and keep the ball rolling, keep the momentum going forward. You know, it's only been a couple of things that have even slightly threatened the suburban paradigm. First, the oil embargo problems of the 1970s, which started people to think a little bit about it and really did lead to the first wave of gentrification in some of our cities. The next thing that's come along, really, is the bursting of the housing bubble and the what's looking like a very long-term, unresolvable problem with money, banking, finance, and anything having to do with available capital that allows people to borrow money to live a certain way. And that is the thing that is now going to probably put suburbia out of business even before we have really bad disruptions in oil. There just isn't capital left. There isn't capital to finance the production of home builders. There isn't capital to lend out to the supposed people who would be the customers for that. And we're really done with it. We just don't know it yet. So the suburban project is over.
I would also want to warn them. I think you'd have some warnings about the quality of space in suburbia. You can't maintain it at a high level for everyone. Somebody's going to move into your backyard, and then someone's going to move into that person's backyard, you know? And it keeps diminishing. The quality keeps diminishing as the new generations come.
That actually is responsible for the birth of the NIMBY, not in my backyard. You know, when it really came down to it, nobody wanted another backyard like their backyard in their backyard. And it led to the whole idea that any time the guys with the hard hats show up anywhere near your house, you call your lawyer.
Whereas in a city, though, I would want a city block as nice as my city block behind my city block. In a city, you want more of the same.
That gets to the idea that, you know, whether you're building good stuff or bad stuff, it definitely has an effect on the stuff around it. And the good stuff brings other stuff around it to life. And the bad stuff, which is essentially dead, kills other stuff and infects it and makes it die around it. You know, that's the essential Christopher Alexander idea, that we have choices in the designs that we choose for our habitations, and the stuff either invokes an idea of aliveness or invokes an idea of deadness. And mostly we've made the choice for deadness in America. And the deadness mostly comes from cutting one thing off from another. The aliveness comes from when things have transitions between each other that are graceful, beautiful transitions that allow you to go from one activity to another seamlessly, or from one place to another, or from one room to another. But when you start putting up barriers, including one-way streets with no parking that function like freeways so that, you know, one block is cut off for the next, or you start putting in berms that supposedly protect one use from another but really just isolate them, or when you create housing pods that only connect to the rest of the world by one entrance to the housing development and one exit, then things do not seamlessly connect to each other.
Okay, Jim, I think we should wrap it up. How do you want to sum this up to the people of the past? Because I'm not sure that we've persuaded them yet of the dangers that lie ahead.
I'm not sure that it's really possible to persuade people who get into a certain groove at a certain time in history. You know, their behavior is much more controlled by whatever things are easily at hand and whatever materials and ideas are current at the time. And that's pretty much, I think, what governs people's lives. There is one other big issue, which we didn't even touch on, which is the idea of public transit. And I prefer to use the term public transit rather than mass transit, because whenever you invoke the word mass transit, it seems to summon up the idea of communism and Joseph Stalin and pushing people around. And that's not what public transit is about. It's not about forcing you to do stuff. But, you know, again, one of the big differences between the USA and Europe is that they made the decision to keep their public transit going seamlessly from, you know, the past going into the future. And we had a real cutoff. You know, we just decided, you know, around 1950, you know, we're done with public transportation. We don't care about it anymore. We're only going to make a few gestures. And that had a lot to do with making our cities unusable. So that, you know, not only were they being depopulated, not only were the activities being decanted to the edge, and not only was disinvestment starting to affect them, but you end up in a point where even logistically they're unusable. You can't even go 2 miles across town because there's no way to do it anymore, and it used to be so easy. So the great blunder that I think I would have warned people about was don't rip up the trolley tracks. Don't allow the car companies and the tire companies to destroy your public transit systems. Do everything you can to maintain them. That and not allowing the freeways to enter the city would have had a lot to do with not getting to such a low point that we're at now. You know, I do have to add, you know, and I've said this before, I think that all of our cities are going to contract and densify at their centers, the ones that are going to make it anyway. I wouldn't include the ones that aren't going to make it, like Tucson and Las Vegas and Phoenix. You know, for, you know, they'll be overwhelmed. But all the other cities, whether they're large or small, are probably going to densify. You know, this, whatever the suburban edges are going to kind of rot away over the next 100, 200 years. The action is going to be in town. It does present tremendous opportunities for young people who, you know, may not know it because their whole experience has been suburban so far, but a lot of their lives are actually going to be taking place very differently. And, you know, they're coming out of college with maybe no idea of what the shape and texture of life is going to be for their adulthood. And I think it isn't going to be what they experienced in the suburban utopia of our time.
Well, Jim, I think that if I were to go back in the past, I would say to the people of the past what someone from the future would probably say to us after listening to the show. I've seen the future, and it's not what you expect.
It might have been you. Somebody sent me one of those wonderful illustrations that I collect of the city of the future drawn in 1914. It was explicitly New York. And the thing that was so impressive about it, it was a cross-section of, like, Park Avenue, going underground about four levels, where they had rationally put all of the service infrastructure, including the automobile corridors, had all been put underground. And the thing that amazed me about it was how wonderfully rational it all was. You know, the streets were quite nice. There were no cars up on Park Avenue as there are now. And this was the city of the future. In fact, they were quite precise about the date, which was, it was in 1914, doing a picture of 1950. You had the subway, so you had public transit on, like, level 3. You had the cars in these underground boulevards on level 2. You know, you had some other stuff on the first basement level. And ultimately, way down below, you had, you know, the water mains and the electric lines and all that stuff.
And the Morlocks below that.
Oh, yeah, well, they didn't go below that. But what amazed me was the rationality of it all. And we have to remember that human beings are wonderfully intelligent and rational animals. If you put somebody down at a drawing board and a computer and you ask them to visually describe the perfect urban organism, you know, they're smart enough to come up with these wonderful systems and these wonderful ways of doing things. The trouble is that, you know, human life is very, very sketchy and dodgy and imperfect and impromptu, and it's interrupted by all kinds of fiascos and blunders and disasters that, you know, sometimes can go on for decades or centuries, and an awful lot of stuff doesn't work out. And so, you know, I talk to a lot of people who have a big interest in rational planning, and you know, it gets back maybe to Ebenezer Howard at the turn of the 19th and 20th century and his diagrammatic plans for the garden cities of outside of London. And they were all wonderfully rational. You know, they had allocated all the little agricultural plots to the right places, and it was perfectly circular, so that was a nice geometric pattern, and nothing that would ever really occur in emergently in nature, of course. But this goes along with, you know, the growing industrialism of modern times has also provoked this kind of grandiosity in us, thinking that, you know, if we're so good at building everything from a Toyota to an atom bomb, then, you know, we must be able to plan all our other stuff rationally. But the trouble is, even though we can do the schematic, diagrammatic plans, we can't necessarily make them come out that way. So it's really a question of what's going to be happening. Now, I'm fully convinced and serenely convinced that what we're going to see from now on is going to be largely an impromptu thing. People are going to be making stuff up as they go along, because we're mostly going to be using leftover materials, leftover buildings, leftover salvaged stuff that we're going to put stuff together with. And I'm quite sure that we'll do good stuff with it, just as the people in the Middle Ages did pretty good stuff with what Rome left over. You know, and maybe the people after us, after them, will do better. But it's going to be impromptu, and it's going to be emergent, and it's going to be not quite exactly what we all expect. And I'm kind of excited about it, because this whole, you know, modernity has been extremely tiresome for me. I don't even like the costumes we wear anymore. I want to wear a sword.
Well, like James Howard Kunstler, I too am very excited about the future, and I think it will be something spontaneous, emergent, and unplanned by any small group of individuals. In our second hour, this avenue is going to be pursued by Jeff Vail, who's looking at transition away from the nation state to more autonomous forms of community, less hierarchical ones which don't demand such energy. I think a lot of the standard thinking about public transport, mass transit, may be predicated on ideas like, well, we have to get all these people to offices and they all have to be working in factories. And I think the future may be quite different. If it's involving low energy, people might start to think about growing their own food as being a first priority, and perhaps one of only very few priorities, not involving regular turning up at factories, dropping children off to school, or doing many of the other things that in the modern existence seem like unquestionably important routines. For our listeners in the so-called developed world, recall that many, many people in the world still don't do any of these things, and they manage to live quite comfortably, official designations of poverty notwithstanding. So I certainly wouldn't want to predict how cities would be evolving in 100 years' time. I wouldn't even want to talk about 10 years, because as I think we're on the brink of something quite unprecedented in human history, it's a mistake to extrapolate existing trends. Now we're going to hear a speech by Jeff Tomlin, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, that's ecoshock.org, entitled Alive Transportation, Fitness, Safety, Community and Trust, which expounds on some of the points made by James Howard Kunstler, and with his talk of changing the goals of how should transportation effectiveness be measured, is a lead-in to a final presentation from Jeff Vail, who is challenging larger societal goals.
I'm going to talk about a lot of problems, particularly health problems that are rooted in the decisions that we make in all of our cities about transportation, say a few words about how we got stuck in this predicament, and talk about the benefits of active transportation, and with a few things that your cities can do. I have about 70 slides to cover in about 20 minutes, so we're going to move quickly, so sit back, relax, and put your thinking caps on. So, why does active transportation matter? One of the things that I love about the health industry is they have really, really good data. And unlike my industry, they actually do follow-up studies to see how their predictive tools actually worked and then make adjustments accordingly. And so in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has compiled trend data about a whole host of diseases, including obesity, and tracked that over time. So in 1986, we can look at the darker states that have significant rates of obesity. 1991, 1997, 2000. Oh, we have to change the scale in 2004. 2005, we change the scale again. Time is speeding up. 2007, 2008, 2009. Obesity is a severe problem in the United States, and it is a problem that's rooted not just in diet, but even more so in activity, and that corresponds even more greatly with some of the diseases that are correlated with obesity and lack of activity, particularly diabetes, 1994, 2001, 2007. A third of adults in huge parts of my country diagnosed with diabetes. Another delightful disease that is causing increase in affliction is asthma. And one of the interesting studies back in 2000, during the Olympics in Atlanta, like in the 80 Olympics in Los Angeles, the transportation officials there said, oh my God, transportation chaos is going to be gridlock. It'll just be horrible. Nobody drive. And so as a result, nobody drove. And in fact, the freeways were empty in Atlanta during the Olympics. And the health professionals there actually went to all the hospitals and collected data about who came to the hospital and under what conditions. They found a dramatic drop during that period of no driving in asthma, while at the same time, there was little, if any, drop in other reported conditions of the hospitals. So driving results in asthma, and it also results in a whole host of other conditions. And while the newspaper headlines get us all afraid of, you know, shark attack and plane crash and some mountain lion attack or something crazy going on in our community, in fact, the number one cause of death among teenagers in the United States is motor vehicle crashes. And fourth among all causes of death in the United States, and more importantly, a whole variety of related conditions, cancer, congenital anomalies, heart disease, are all related to transportation factors, particularly the lack of active transportation in our lives. The social sciences have also started to track data that relates to transportation. In fact, created a name for an entirely new condition called road rage, which there are endless scholarly articles that describe exactly the array, the soup of toxic chemicals that our own brains produce when dealing with the unique stresses associated with driving. These stresses and these health problems are worse if you happen to be young or old or brown or poor, and particularly if you're old. In fact, one of the greatest problems that most cities in North America are about to face in the coming decades is the number of people who are going to be over 65 and who are stranded in communities where walking cannot be a part of daily life. The science of gerontology teaches us that the minute we stop walking, we basically start dying. It's a huge problem. And I don't even need to get into the whole conversation about the relationship between our transportation decisions and global warming. In California, about 40% of our CO2 emissions are transport sector, and of that, 70% is us driving around. So, what's at the root of all these problems? How could we have allowed the frog to be sitting in the pot of water while it's now at a full boil? Well, there's a simple answer, and it's this. Even though we know that sprawl equals death, that the fatality rate in our sprawling locations is 3, 5, in some cases 10 times greater, the traffic fatality rate, than it is in our more walkable urban centers, and that the lower density community we live in, the more driving that we do, the fatter that it makes us, the more unhealthy that it makes us, and that the social costs of all of this are astronomical. In San Francisco, the public health department has been keeping track just of the actual hospitalization and healthcare costs of pedestrian fatalities. It totaled $75 million over the course of 5 years, just dealing with cleaning up, the physical cleanup of pedestrian-related crashes in one city in 5 years, during a period of time when the Transportation Department had very, very little money to spend on pedestrian safety efforts. Instead, we're spending $75 million public money in the public health hospital in cleaning up after the fact. So, what next? Well, the reason for all of this is not because the market has demanded that we live in auto-dependent communities, but the fact that our laws require it. In nearly every city that I work, this one is a very unusual exception. It is illegal to create the kind of walkable communities that we know the market is demanding and that Hank has told us in the United Kingdom the market is absolutely demanding. And all of this in spite of the fact that every planning document that I ever read has all the good words in it. It's, you know, mixed-use neighborhoods and density near transit, reducing vehicle miles traveled, reduce CO2, promote walking and biking, blah, 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 motherhood and apple pie. And yet, when we go into the actual law, into the funding formulas, into the street design standards, into the nuts and bolts of the zoning code, this is what results. This is a walkable community because you've got a mix of uses up there, and there's a pedestrian and a crosswalk. So we've met the goals of our general plan in delivering what we've required. And so we wonder, however, if perhaps there is a bit of a mixed message. So, what's the solution? Well, as our previous speakers have already mentioned, in fact, all of them, there's a powerful relationship between density and the rates of driving. And the sweet spot that occurs in our old streetcar neighborhoods, in townhouses, in the places where that still accommodate the car, and yet don't require a car for all trips. You don't need the density of Manhattan in order to have a walkable, healthy, sustainable community. Another thing that we've learned, and you'll notice the same shape of curve, is that the best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. The best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. In fact, if you double the rate of walking, you decrease your risk of a traffic fatality by 66%. Another important bit of research that hasn't been updated since Donald Appleyard did it in the 1970s is the relationship between how we do transportation and our community health. You'll notice in the top diagram from Donald Appleyard's famous book, Livable Streets, he actually interviewed every household on streets of varying level of traffic, and he found that in a street with a relatively light amount of traffic, still a fair amount of traffic, the people living on that block had 3 friends on that block per person and about 6.3 acquaintances. You increase the traffic, however, on a similarly designed street, and the number of friends drops to 0.9 per person and only 3 acquaintances. And more importantly, when he interviewed people in more detail, the amount of trust on the block with less traffic was extraordinarily high. People would lend their keys to their neighbors, you know, when they were on vacation, take care of their dogs and water their plants and so on. That didn't happen on the block with lots of traffic. We also find increasingly in the medical research that not only is exercise really important for a whole lot of cardiovascular reasons, but green exercise, outdoor exercise, even for short periods of time, is strongly positively correlated with better self-esteem, happier moods, and this is true particularly for young people and for people who are suffering from mental illnesses. Another interesting factor that I am completely fascinated by is a remarkable neuropeptide that our brain produces called oxytocin. This has been in the press a fair amount recently. It is the biological reason for trust and generosity and empathy. It lowers blood pressure, and it increases social behavior such as friendliness. In fact, it's so powerful that it's now being marketed out there on the market where you put this little spray, and I won't show the other images that are associated with it, but you can imagine that this ad is not for oxytocin, but It's a remarkable chemical in that the most powerful way that our body releases it is, of course, during sex, also during breastfeeding.